passage I wanted to reflect upon this morning. This is a text from the Samyutta Nikaya. For those of you not familiar with the organization of the Pali Canon, this is one of the five main collections of discourses, which are called in English the connected discourses. In other words, each chapter is focusing on a particular theme. And the theme of this particular text is mindfulness of the breath. It's called the Anapanasati Samyutta, the connected discourses on mindfulness of the breath. And the setting here is a little bit unusual. It's not just somebody going up to the Buddha and asking a question and getting a reply. But this is actually an occasion when a student of the Buddha, presumably one of the bhikkhus, one of the mendicants, puts to the Buddha a question that he or she has been asked by the by just the lay people around. And it concerns what the Buddha does during the 3-month rains retreat. As you're probably aware, in India during the monsoon period, particularly at the time of the Buddha, it wasn't possible for anyone to get around. So the monks and the nuns would not, you know, wander from village to village during this period, but they would gather together in parks, groves, and they would live for 3 months as a community, basically. And they would devote this time to formal practices like meditation, and also they would have discussions and they would listen to talks and so forth and so on. And understandably, people began to wonder, well, okay, the monks and the nuns and the other lay supporters, they go and do their meditations, but what about the Buddha himself? You know, what sort of practice does he do? He's the Buddha, right? He's the awakened one. You know, why does he have to meditate? I thought that was just for beginners like us. And so they put this question to the monks around the Buddha, and then one of them went to the Buddha and asked, you know, what do we tell these people? And this is the Buddha's reply. He says, during the rains residence, friend, the teacher, the Bhagwan, generally dwells in concentration through mindfulness of breathing. For if one could say of anything, this is a noble dwelling, this is a sacred dwelling, this is a Tathagata's dwelling. It is of concentration through mindfulness of breathing that one could truly say this. Now, I remember when I first read that passage, I was slightly surprised. And I think that surprise was a reflection of my own prejudices and assumptions. Namely, that surely a person like the Buddha of his great attainment and so forth would not do something as basic as just being attentive of the breath. And yet that's exactly what the Buddha says he does. That during these retreats, he, as the text says, dwells in concentration through mindfulness of breathing. For those of you who were at the talk tonight, last night, we looked a bit at this phrase, this verb that occurs a great deal in the early canon, viharati, to dwell. When the Buddha speaks of emptiness, for example, he talks of emptiness as being a dwelling, an abode, a place where you live. He doesn't speak of it as something that you try to understand or get insight into. It's a space from which you live your life. We'll come back to this afternoon. So again, he talks of mindfulness of the breathing as a kind of dwelling, a kind of abiding. Now again, this word dwelling, abiding, living, these are so familiar to us that we use them in ordinary speech without really thinking much about what they mean. But in a sense, perhaps the most fundamental activity we perform as human beings is to dwell on this earth, is to abide here, to dwell. And mindfulness of the breath is a way of dwelling, a way of being on the earth, a way of being here, a way of living. Now this is quite in contrast to the idea that our technologically oriented society often speaks of meditation as a technique. Mindfulness of the breath is a meditation technique that brings us to greater stillness and calm in our lives and so on. As soon as we use that kind of language, we've somehow distanced ourselves from the primary act of dwelling, of abiding. And we've already started to talk about gaining proficiency in a certain exercise or technique. In other words, something that we think we can, if we practice it hard enough, we'll get better at it. We'll be a really good mindfulness of the breath meditator. And we'll get some sort of kudos out of that, perhaps. Of course, there is a technical aspect to this meditation. We can develop it and cultivate it and perhaps get better at it. But that mindset, it strikes me, has already disassociated the practice from something more primary. And the primary act, as it were, is that of simply dwelling, abiding, living, being on this earth. So I find it helpful to revisit some of these very fundamental ideas and to reflect on them, to contemplate what they mean. And I think for many of us today, we are unavoidably conscious of how our dwelling on this earth is in many ways destructive. That we have all of the things that we need, really. A consumer society is one that is very good at satisfying certain needs. And there are many good things about it, I think, in bringing people out of poverty and so forth. But if we try to think of it as a way of dwelling, then it's quite a far cry from the sort of simple, unpretentious, very centered lives we might associate with a figure like the Buddha or with Christ or other such people who have really dedicated their lives not, I think, to gaining great insights or understandings, but in some very fundamental way to how we live on this earth, how we dwell here, how we abide. So the breathing, and this is the practice I'll suggest that we do throughout the day, is getting into touch with our bodies in their most primary relationship with the environment that we inhabit. With each breath we draw air, and that air then oxygenates our blood, and that allows our brain and nervous system and our organism to continue its life. So there's something very, very primordial about breathing. And for the Buddha, that breathing is a way in which we dwell. But he then extends this. He describes this dwelling as in three different ways. He says that this dwelling is an Arya Vihara, a Brahma Vihara, and a Tathagata Vihara. So again, he doesn't explain what he means by these terms. But Arya, in the language of his time, meant something like noble or dignified. It does, of course, have the connotation in India of the Aryan peoples who supposedly occupied the Gangetic Basin about 1,000 years before the Buddha's birth. And so there might have been still some certain sense of it identifying a particular ethnic type. But that's certainly not how the Buddha uses the word. For him to be Arya means to have achieved a kind of moral dignity in your life. And remember, he talks of the path itself as the Arya Magga, the noble way, the noble path, the noble eightfold path. So this is a term that's clearly quite central to his thinking. So this dwelling in the breath is not just a simple mechanical description of how a sentient organism draws breath and thereby survives. That would be reducing it perhaps too far to basically what, you know, all mammals and birds and so forth would be doing. But this is also a dwelling that affords us a certain dignity. The word noble literally means raised up. It raises us up to a more dignified kind of being on this earth. I remember many years ago being very struck, before I knew much about Buddhist philosophy, let's say, by images of monks and nuns, and I particularly remember images from Japan, of a monk or a nun just sitting in a rock garden or in a zendo, and being profoundly struck by the posture itself. There was no text accompanying these images, there really didn't need to be. But something was being communicated by the very act, by the very posture of sitting itself in silence. And what I think must have touched me at that time was the dignity of that posture. That this is a person who is upright, but not righteous in that sense, not somehow stiff in a militaristic way. Upright, but at the same time deeply relaxed and still and quiet and poised and balanced. And that, I think, captures, perhaps better than words can capture, the dignity of sitting, the dignity of just breathing. So it's a state of being totally present, totally aware, a state in which your body is allowing itself the optimal opportunity to breathe freely and deeply and naturally. And that provides a kind of ground for a presence of mind, a still, clear presence of mind that rests and returns and dwells in the rhythm of the breath. The next term the Buddha uses is Brahma Vihara, which I've translated as a sacred dwelling. Now, this is a little unusual, because the term Brahma Vihara is generally understood as dwelling in loving kindness, in compassion, in sympathetic joy or rejoicing, and in equanimity. And I don't know if there are any other occasions in the suttas where the Buddha adds to that mindfulness of the breath. And he describes the mindfulness of the breathing with a term that has a somewhat ambiguous standing in early Buddhist literature, and that is the idea of Brahma, which we might loosely translate as God. There are certain suttas where the Buddha's somewhat mocking of the claims that Brahma makes to be the creator of the world and so on. So on a theological level, the Buddha doesn't really have any room for such a concept of God. But he doesn't therefore abandon using the term. And again, this is quite characteristic of his teaching style, is to take words that are used in quite different contexts at his time and invest them with new meaning. He just does this with Brahmin, with karma, with Arya, and here with Brahma. So he's not therefore rejecting the idea of there being something sacred. What he's questioning is the need to believe in some sort of supernaturalistic deity of any kind. Nor is he a pantheist in the sense that he'll say that everything is Brahma. But he does acknowledge that qualities such as love, qualities such as compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity and mindfulness of the breath have something sacred about them. So what might that mean in a non-theistic tradition? I think what is perhaps common to all of these Brahma Viharas, these sacred dwellings, is that they are ways of dwelling in the on the earth in which we go beyond our own preoccupations with me and mine. I mean, this is quite clear with metta, with loving kindness. It's focused on others being happy. Compassion, focused on a wish that others don't suffer. Sympathetic joy, a celebration in the success of others. And equanimity, also, it's not just an inner state of mind, but it's a balanced state of mind that doesn't, as it were, give in to the attraction to one person and the aversion to another. In other words, all of these virtues are social virtues in that sense. To include mindfulness of the breath, I think, if we follow that line of reasoning, is also pointing to the fact that when we breathe, we are engaging with a world that transcends anything to do with me and mine. That we're becoming aware of our intimate reliance and dependence upon an atmosphere, an environment, a biosphere. Nowadays we would think in terms of the photosynthesis of plants and everything that in this delicate web of life on this planet allows us to be, allows us to dwell at all. And it's got nothing to do with me, it's nothing to do with mine. It has to do with opening ourselves to what's transcends our own specific individuality. So in this sense, the breathing, the dwelling in the breath, has something transcendent about it. It opens us to a world that is not reducible to my interests. Perhaps that's the reason that, or one of the reasons that the Buddha thinks of dwelling in the breath as something transcendent, something that goes beyond our own limited wants and desires and fears and hates. And then he says that this dwelling is a Tathagata's dwelling. Now, I deliberately haven't translated the word Tathagata because I think it's very tricky to translate. Let me just, I'm going to jump around in my iPad a bit. There's a very The word Tathagata is broadly speaking used as a synonym for the Buddha. And often when the Buddha speaks about himself, he doesn't say I. In fact, there is no word I in Pali really. But he uses the word the Tathagata. I find this a little bit hard to credit really. I can't quite visualize people going around talking of themselves as the Tathagata. Tathagata might literally be translated as something like the one who is just so. I don't want to get into a thing about this because it would take us away from our focus. But I found a very interesting definition of this word Tathagata in the numerical discourses. And this is the Buddha speaking. He says, "Bhikkhus, as the Tathagata speaks, so he does. And as he does, so he speaks. Since he does as he speaks, and speaks as he does, therefore he is called the Tathagata." Now, tata means literally like that. Gata literally means gone, but it doesn't mean gone in the sense of some action of moving. What it means really is someone who is just so, is just like that. You have another term in Pali, avijagata, which means literally the one who has gone to ignorance. But what it means obviously is an ignorant person. So Tathagata basically is a person who is just like that. In other words, there's no deception. What the person does is the same as what he says. There's no hypocrisy. There's no misrepresentation. That the person says one thing, or says lots of high-minded things, but then goes off and lives a life that is kind of in conflict with their declared and espoused values. In Chinese tradition, in the Taoist tradition, and in the Confucian tradition, you have this word Chen Jen, which means, it's usually translated as something like the true person. The true person. And I think in many ways the Tathagata is the true person. The person where there is no deceit any longer, no fiction, no pretending. There's a kind of uncompromising directness and honesty. So if we take Tathagata in that sense, then the practice of mindfulness of the breathing is also a state of a complete honesty with yourself. You're not, it's a state of complete lack of pretense. In other words, it's a kind of acceptance in a very radical way of who you are. You're not pretending to be a good Buddhist or meditator. You just allow yourself to, in a sense, present to the world as in fact you are. And again, that sounds nice, but again, if we look at our own lives, how difficult that can be. How in the way we speak, the way we project ourselves, the way we dress, or whatever it might be, to what extent is there a subtext of trying to project an image, a persona, a mask, that in some ways is a deceit, in some ways is perhaps not really showing ourselves, you know, for what we are, in our vulnerability, in our anxiety, in our, you know, our doubts. So someone like myself who has to sit on this chair and deliver this wisdom to you, I'm aware that there are, I aspire to such ideals, for sure. But I'm also very conscious of how I so often fail to live up to them. But that too, in a way, is at least an acknowledgement of that disparity within myself. So the key idea here, I think, is that in sitting here mindfully observing our breathing, our body breathing, we're trying to connect with a fundamental sort of honesty or of clarity, of non-deceptivity, non-deceptiveness, to aspire, as it were, to a kind of truthfulness in our lives, not to deceive. So that's what the Buddha says about mindfulness of the breathing. And as we can see, it goes a long way beyond using mindfulness of the breath as a kind of technique for stilling our wandering mind, although of course it is that as well. He's not speaking of it in a technical language, in the language of an expert meditator. He's speaking of it in a much more holistic sense, as an aspect of how we dwell on the earth, in a way that affords a certain dignity, that affords an opening to what we might consider as sacred, and in terms of how it connects us with a very honest and accepting and true relationship with what's actually going on in our own lives. It also suggests that since this is the meditation that he does himself, that there's something in a way rather fundamental in the practice about mindfulness of the breath. I've always felt, in fact, that all Buddhist meditation for me has always started with mindfulness of the breathing. Even if I might go on to do a Zen practice or some sort of reflection, it begins, it has its starting point in sitting down and reconnecting with my body, my embodiment, and my breath. And that becomes the foundation on which whatever other practice I might pursue starts. And likewise, if I get distracted, if I wander off, I gently bring my attention back to my breath. And not just the breath as a picture in my mind, a kind of a breathing mechanism, a sort of bellows action of my lungs, but rather breathing as a rhythm of the body itself, a primary rhythm of the body itself. And that, appears, is what the Buddha would do when he went in his hut during a range retreat and sat down and meditated. Having said all that about breathing, it's probably a good idea that we actually try it out. And I'm sure most of you have had this experience, but for the lady who is new to this, essentially I think the basic idea is hopefully conveyed by what I've just said, but as an actual exercise, sit down still on the ground as you're sitting now, close your eyes or half close your eyes, maybe focus your attention about 3 feet in front of you, and then just gently let your attention come to be aware of the sensation of breathing. In other words, what it's like for the air to enter the nostrils, to proceed through the windpipe, to fill the lungs and the belly, and then there's a pause, and then it contracts, and you breathe out, and then you breathe in again. And what you, when you're doing this, not to try in any way to control the breathing. It's not pranayama, it's not an exercise in which you are expected to breathe in a very specific and formal way. But it's actually just allowing yourself to come into awareness of the natural rhythm of the breath as it occurs, even if you weren't meditating. That's a little bit tricky, because as soon as we become conscious of the breathing, we tend to assume the role of being the one who's breathing, the breather. We tend to put a sort of brake on the process. And that's difficult to completely let go of. But over time, as you relax into this practice, the breathing becomes less and less contrived, more and more just the natural thing the body does. And you become, as it were, a kind of witness or observer, not in a detached sense, but actually as an organism that participates in the process of breathing. But before we do that, let's stand up for a couple of minutes and stretch our legs.